Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Risky Business Podcast. I'm Patrick Gray. As most of you would know, I've just returned from a couple of weeks off. I had a lovely time doing a spot of camping with the family. I rested up and back on deck and ready to go. And we're going to talk through the key news of the last 3 weeks in just a minute with Adam Boileau. And then we'll jump right into this week's sponsor interview with Kumud Kalia, the Chief Information and Technology Officer of Silence. They actually dropped a really interesting product announcement at RSA a few weeks back, and Kumud will be along a little bit later on to tell us all about that. The TLDR is an agent. It's a software agent that models user behavior. So when someone else starts using the endpoint that agent is installed on to do things that don't fit the user profile, action can be taken. It's the type of stuff that normally belongs in academic papers, not in actual products that people can actually buy to actually use. So yeah, that is an interesting chat, and it's coming up after the news. Speaking of, we've got a stack of amazing news to get through this week. So let's get started on that now with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we got a whole bunch of news to get through this week, of course, because I was on break. And when I go on break, lots of stuff happens. That's usually the way. And probably my favorite story of the last few weeks is this woman who was arrested at Donald Trump's Florida resort, the Mar-a-Lago resort. And she was, you know, she was arrested with two passports on her and a malware-riddled USB stick. She had equipment for detecting video cameras and, you know, like hidden cameras in her hotel room and stuff. Like, she may as well have been just carrying a bag in which was a note that if you opened it up said, "I am doing really shady stuff."
It really did not seem like the most subtle, physical infiltration attempt that we've ever seen reported. I mean, none of the story makes a whole bunch of sense, I suppose. I mean, she had a fairly flimsy reason to be there that changed every time someone talked to her. And yeah, like carrying, 9 USB sticks, some of which appeared to have USB malware on them. Just, you know, kind of not a good look. Makes you wonder what she was planning to do. The headlines, of course, have made, or at least the InfoSec, you know, coverage of this has been pretty funny. With there was some report that one of the Secret Service agents that was involved in investigating her, interrogating her, plugged one of the USB sticks into his computer and then said that bad things started happening and he had to turn it off very quickly. Which a lot of people have been making a lot of hay out of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't really surprise me that you arrest a suspect. You know, they've got USB devices. You're going to have a look on them, right, to see, to get more insight on your suspect. And I think Secret Service has put out a statement since saying, it wasn't connected to the network, something. And they've kind of like really ambiguously worded the statement to try to imply that it was plugged into an isolated environment. But really, if I'm parsing that statement carefully, it looks like what they're saying is, it wasn't on the Wi-Fi, so it's fine.
Yeah, I think an Ars write-up of the, they had something on background from the Secret Service, and they said, it's policy that we would only plug it into machines that weren't connected to the network, as opposed to saying we didn't plug it into a machine that was connected to the network. So yeah, maybe a little bit of weaseling going on there. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, of course, the other big news that we missed while we were on break is this, blockbuster story here by Kim Zetter for Vice Motherboard. What's interesting about this one, because I've spoken to Kim about this, and the way she got this story was just the Kaspersky conference is happening in Singapore at the moment. The way she got this story was she just asked them, "Hey, do you have any interesting talks coming up?" And yes, they did.
Yeah, now this one is super interesting. Kaspersky have been investigating some kind of malware campaign that involved malware being loaded into signed updates distributed by Asus, the Taiwanese hardware and device vendor. So somebody owned some bit of their infrastructure, got into the place where they could modify updates that were then subsequently re-signed with Asus's keys and then distributed out to people who are updating their software. Now that, supply chain attacks we've seen before, it's kind of interesting. Obviously, the fact that signed is, kind of interesting. But where this starts to get more curious is that this was really pretty targeted. There was a list in the malware that was distributed of hashed MAC addresses, and this particular like the first stage that was being dropped, would double check all the network interfaces, the wireless interfaces and any other, you know, wired Ethernet interfaces against this list of MAC addresses. And then only if they match, go off and get the second stage, which is, you know, pretty targeted.
Well, it is. And it makes you wonder, where are they getting that MAC address address list from, right? How are they correlating people's MAC addresses to their real life identities? And that tends to suggest this is a crew that has fairly broad insight, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly suggests targeted. It suggests that they've got some, you know, some other place to get that information. You know, wireless network cards obviously can broadcast their MAC addresses around the place for people to see. But yeah, it suggests that this is a follow-on or something that's trying to catch a particular thing. Although the list of MAC addresses, you know, of course, or the hashes of the MAC addresses was publicized relatively rapidly. And of course, going through and brute forcing out what those MAC addresses are, you know, given it's MD5, pretty fast as well. So we have a list of MAC addresses, and some of them are less specific than you would hope. Like one of them, for example, is the MAC address of one of the VMware, like virtual Ethernet interfaces it uses when you're running VMware on your machine. So it's a MAC address that's used by a whole lot of people. Yeah. There's some other examples of like Huawei mobile dongles that have the same MAC address on every device. So things like that were not, you know, as hyper-targeted as you would imagine. But on the other hand, we're talking...
But one thing that's interesting here is they kind of seem to be linking this to the CCleaner attack, right? Because ASUS was, you know, a target of that attack, which was a separate supply chain infiltration, right? So you're telling me that they might be targeting people who are running VMware on the desktop? That's not really that surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, you know, it's not an unreasonable thing to imagine that that would be a reasonable target. And the link to CCleaner and there was one other thing, supply chain attack that was tied to this crowd as well, you know, does suggest, you know, a fairly sophisticated set of adversaries with real tasking.
Yeah, I spoke to Kim Zetter about this, and she says, you know, her takeaway here is she's a little bit worried that we could see people avoiding updates because of all of these sort of supply chain attacks. Here's what she said.
We're seeing more and more attacks like that, right? Where the hackers go after an intermediary only because that intermediary is a bridge to the victim that they really want. And in some cases, it's a single victim. But of course, when you're talking about supply chain like this and a trusted supply chain channel for software updates, then, you know, it's kind of a goldmine. And the potential is massive, you know, with thousands, hundreds of thousands of customers in this case. The takeaway here, I think the most important takeaway, is that this issue in particular about software update delivery is broken, I think. The concern, of course, is that it will make people stop updating their software. And that's a real risk here. I mean, we already have a lot of people who don't update software already, either because they're lazy or they're concerned that it's going to break their system in some way. And so this adds another complexity to that, another reason not to update software. And so I think that there is a bit of an urgency around trying to fix this issue of authenticating these updates.
Now, I think she makes a good point there. I mean, I'm personally not going to be too concerned about running operating system patches, but I'm already, and I have been for some time, a little bit worried when I see some of my more obscure software pop up and say, I have an update available. You know, it doesn't, you know, it always makes you worry a little bit, doesn't it, these days?
You're right, it does. And I mean, especially for, you know, this sort of second tier of equipment vendor, you know, like ASUS, where, you know, you're never really clear what's in the updates, and, you know, authenticating the fact that the updates are real can be fiddly. You know, if it's Microsoft or Google or something like that, then you've got a reasonable, you know, kind of place to go look at, and you kind of trust the infrastructure to work there with, you know, other vendors that take it less serious. And I think, well, you know, it's worth mentioning that ASUS really have not handled this well in this case. It really doesn't build confidence. And yeah, I think she's right. I mean, there is a real risk that people start to, you know, distrust updates. And, you know, in some cases, that's actually warranted, as it was in this case.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Now, as I mentioned, the Kaspersky Security Analyst Summit is taking place in Singapore. And, you know, I got to admit, right, like they have a habit of belting out some pretty good content every year. And a couple of the guys from Chronicle, including one ex-Kaspersky staffer, had a really interesting talk on some malware that looks to be linked to Flame. So the idea was, you know, Flame, of course, was sort of pegged to Western, maybe Israeli intelligence. I can't quite remember, but, you know, on that side of the of the equation, no pun intended. So it looked like, you know, after Flame was burned, a lot of that code did actually get recycled into new stuff that was hanging around until, I think, 2016. But looks like an interesting talk, that one.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of show that, you know, sometimes this relatively high quality, relatively expensive tooling, like, it does die pretty slow. And it's very tempting to take something that's worked, that's been burnt, and rework it so that you can keep on using some of those capabilities. And the work that they've been doing here, pulling the thread on this particular, you know, kind of Flame Mark II, you know, does seem pretty sophisticated and in line with, you can see why they say it's, you know, begat from the same code base and made by the same crew.
Now, just a moment ago, we were talking about some supply chain concerns. You know, in the ASUS case, supply chain stuff seems to be making up, a bigger and bigger chunk of this show, every month. But there's a great write-up here from SNCC about the, you know, essentially the trojaning of a popular Ruby thing called Bootstrap SaaS. What can you tell us about this one, Adam?
Bootstrap SaaS is SaaS is a CSS preprocessor. In this case, this is the one for using with the Twitter Bootstrap set of front-end themes. And in this case, this is the version of that that's been packaged for use with Ruby and distributed through their RubyGems package manager. So, background. In this case, someone appears to have pushed a malicious version of that package up into the repositories for RubyGems package manager. Look for a base64 Ruby code and a magic cookie name and just execute it if you happen to be using this package. Pretty smooth backdoor. Good example of, you know, the sorts of niche bits of the supply chain. I mean, who knows whether or not any particular Rails project or Ruby project, you know, uses the SAS preprocessor on its CSS. You know, who knows, right? And this would get, you know, a reasonable amount of people owned. This package
That's what I mean. You know, you say a reasonable amount of people, it's a lot of people.
Yeah, well, I think they said, 27 million downloads on Bootstrap SaaS. But then again, how much of that is the RubyGem package? Well, I wasn't quite clear. So, I mean, either way, it's still, I mean, SaaS is pretty widely used. Bootstrap's really widely used. Ruby's pretty widely used. So, yeah, it makes sense that a bunch of people got a bunch of owned.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I just think back to that interview I did with Rob Joyce earlier in the year, you know, of the NSA. And we were sort of talking about that Bloomberg, you know, hardware bullshit story and, you know, asking him, do you worry about that? And he said, I worry more about the software supply chain. And we've got a few good examples in this week's show about why that's completely justified. Now, I think just before I went on break, Norsk Hydro had been dealing with a pretty severe ransomware outbreak. And it's been a really interesting response from them. I mean, they've even been releasing videos onto YouTube showing their workers going back to manual processes and how they dealt with it. I think that's a fantastic response from a PR point of view. Looks like this was very much a targeted type of attack. It's cost them 40 mil, and they decided not to pay the ransom and just roll from backups. But this is shaping up as a case study for the ages, this one.
Yeah, I mean, this does seem to be a pretty good example of, you know, fairly big ransomware deployment. You know, the crew that's deploying this one, the Lokagaga ransomware, like, they seem to be targeting big organizations, right? It's not just, you know, throw it at everybody and see what sticks. Like, they seem to be targeting people. They appear to have handled, you know, a very serious ransomware case and, you know, are pulling through it and, you know, rolling for backups, not paying the thing. That's, you know, and communicating that that's what they're doing, I think, is a good example for other people, even though probably it would have been better and easier for them to have patched their Windows in the first place and not have to handle this.
Well, some of these crews are getting actually a little bit scary good. Like, the days of the wide net ransomware just, you know, arriving via email and hosing people, you know, those days, I think, they're kind of over, really. What we're talking about here are really sort of targeted. There seems to be these more targeted ransomware cases where people will manually get access to an environment and then the ransomware is a way to monetize that access. And I think we're going to see more of that.
Yeah, and we certainly are. I mean, there's been a bunch of stories and some even by the same crew in the news list this week of various people getting hit by this. And yeah, you're right. It does seem, you know, that, you know, people are actually going by hand to deploy this malware as opposed to just blasting it out via email. I'm actually taking steps to, you know, move laterally, escalate their access inside the corporate environment and then deploy it as a way to monetize, as you said.
Yeah, a couple of chemical companies got hit this week, as well as Arizona Beverages. And yeah, it's bad times. Toyota announced a security breach in Japan, saying that attackers may have stolen the details of 3.1 million Toyota and Lexus car owners. I think there may have also been a breach in at Toyota Vietnam, but I'm relying on a shoddily, you know, Google translated page to get to that. But look, you know, it's been funny watching a lot of this coverage link back to us, because we spoke about the attack against Toyota Australia, in which APT-32, a Vietnamese crew, are suspected of doing that. I've heard, though, that, you know, these attacks here that we're talking about now, don't really connect to the Australia attack. They're not really APT-32 related. And that would make sense, because I don't see why APT-32 would be going after, you know, Toyota customer information.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it would line up, although, you know, it's kind of hard to say whether, you know, when you see reports like this, you know, you don't really know what's been going on inside the environment. And, you know, we do see people, you know, kind of muddy the waters about what they're up to inside a particular environment if they feel that they're going to get snapped or they're in the process of being investigated. So yeah, it is hard to say, because no one talks about what actually happens, you know, during incident response.
Yeah. Now moving on to the Huawei section of the show, which there seems to be one. Look, we've got a nice story here from Lily Hay Newman on Wired, talking about how, you know, she's done a write-up on the Huawei like oversight panel in the UK. They've released their annual report that's from last month this year. She's done a write-up on that, saying, you know, Huawei's problem isn't Chinese backdoors, it's buggy software. You know, and that report really did shred Huawei. And we're in this really interesting situation where we've got the NCSC, the UK's NCSC, saying we can mitigate the risks of a Huawei deployment for 5G. And then we've got the Huawei Cybersecurity Evaluation Center Oversight Board. You know, they put out that previous report talking about, you know, reproducible builds and, you know, certain risks that couldn't be mitigated. And now they're putting out this report that says Huawei code is junk. It's interesting, isn't it, that we've got the NCSC in conflict with this board in terms of the general messaging around what they think of Huawei.
Yeah, you'd really hope that they would get their ducks in a row before they started, you know, trying to convince us of exactly what they want. The main report from that committee is, you know, is pretty extensive reading. If you want to read that, it's in the show notes for you to digest. But yeah, it kind of breaks down between the technical issues, you know, of the software quality of the bugs and stuff, and then the sort of like, how do we actually validate the issues, the things like reproducible builds, things like making sure that the hardware you're running is actually running the software that you analyzed. Actually, it's interesting that some of the reporting in particular, Lily Hay Newman's one, you know, kind of made it out like that's the easy bit of it, like even as simple as checking that they're running the same software. And in fact, actually, that's quite hard. And I think there's quite a lot of vendors that would struggle to be able to assert that to their customers as well. But yeah, it is interesting, you know, the correlation between the technical aspects of it, the kind of where it turned geopolitical, and then the one of the other bits of the report that's particularly critical is the fact that Huawei just hasn't made any progress delivering on their assurances from the previous year. We talked, I guess a year ago now, about the last one, and how Huawei had this plan that they were going to address a bunch of these issues from the code quality point of view and from the, you know, the auditability point of view. And the report is basically saying they've made no progress. We can't see them making any progress. You know, this is really bad. And I think that's one of the things that struck me as different this year versus last year.
I think one point that you did make, though, recently when talking about all of this stuff, is it would be interesting to see what would happen if other networking vendors like Cisco, if Cisco were put under the same microscope. Do you know what I mean? Like, would we be reading a different report? And I'm not sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, I've seen a bunch of Cisco gear over the years in various places that I've looked at. And yeah, I would not say that the Huawei gear is materially worse than the Cisco gear, or even some of the other vendors as well. You know, Juniper got their stuff backdoor. There's all sorts of bad things that happened.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to see the same degree of scrutiny applied to all the vendors. And I think that would be, you know, not an unreasonable thing to say. I mean, whether it's an Ericsson or Alcatel-Lucent, Nortel, Shanghai Bell, or whoever it happens to be that you're putting in the middle of your telco core, I'd really like to see this level of scrutiny done for everyone. And I think, you know, we'd all benefit from that.
Now, it's been a little while since Jeff Bezos wrote that Medium post in which he said, yes, you know, the National Enquirer has my nudes, but I will not buckle. I will not buckle. Great post, by the way, that one. And of course, there was this big investigation into how his conversations with his girlfriend were leaked. And there was a little bit of chatter around that time emanating from the Bezos camp that somehow Saudi Arabia might have been involved. Now, the investigator that Bezos hired, the one that he gave unlimited budget to get to the bottom of this, his name is Gavin De Becker. And he's actually written a post up for Daily Beast in which he says that he believes the Saudis did have access to Jeff Bezos's phone. And, you know, the National Enquirer going after this material from Bezos's girlfriend's brother might have been a case of parallel construction or something. Look, it's an interesting read, but they have coughed up nothing in the way of evidence. And in fact, NSO Group has had to issue a statement saying we can say categorically our technology wasn't involved because it can't be used against targets with US phone numbers. So, but I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, when you've got these sort of allegations being made without any supporting facts tendered, it's hard to know, but it's still a fun read.
Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously, we were hoping for more juicy details of the of actual technical evidence, which we haven't seen. Gavin De Becker's write-up, I mean, it kind of makes sense. Like, the story seems to fit the narrative as presented. So, I mean, I kind of look at it and I can imagine the Saudis doing it. But yeah, it would be nice to see some technical evidence. He does say that, you know, they've handed over, you know, their work to US law enforcement and, as a result, they're not saying anything more, but, you know, of course, we'd like to see more.
Now we're going to talk about Exodus. This is a mobile, you know, what looks to be, you know, government surveillance type stuff that has been squeezed into apps on the Play Store. It looks like it also affects iOS, but this is one of those, you know, companies, the company that makes this, I believe, is best known for making like CCTV cameras, but they've gone into this spyware business and their Trojan sucks, right? So not only have they put this stuff into apps that anyone can download, but it's got things like, I think it's got like a vulnerable listener on it that anyone can connect to. So if you've got this stuff on your phone, like, you are terribly vulnerable to all sorts of bad things. I think it does C2 as HTTP, you know, just bad, 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 bad. What do we know about this one, Exodus? It popped up in Italy, didn't it?
This was packaged initially in a site that looked like information pages from a couple of mobile carriers, one in Italy and one in Turkmenistan. So I guess they're targeting people in those particular places. And it was packaged in the Google App Store, like in the actual Google Play Store, which is not great, whereas the Apple one, the Apple version of it, was being distributed using the old enterprise certificate, you know, social engineer someone to actually installing it through that mechanism approach, which, you mean, is good and bad, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine too many innocent targets of this thing are going to, you know, like, people who aren't targets are going to be downloading these super obscure apps. But it's not really the point, is it? I mean, you should not be making stuff publicly available that is going to weaken people's devices like this.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, if you, there's some onus, I suppose, on you if you're going to distribute, you know, this kind of tool to make sure that it's not going to be abused, at least if you're, you know, claiming to be a legitimate operator of some sort. But yeah, I mean, it's just rubbish, you know, both from a technical perspective, but also, you know, the fact that someone thinks this is all right to do.
Yeah. Joel Shetman and Chris Bing, of course, wrote up the stories about the UAE and Project Raven. We got another piece in that series now showing that the UAE were spying on all sorts of journalists, like a BBC host, the chairman of Al Jazeera, and other prominent Arab media figures.
Yeah, now this is a really interesting write-up because often, you know, often we talk about the technical aspects of these kinds of campaigns and we never really get to see, you know, specifically who's getting owned and for what reason. And this is, you know, it's kind of nice to, I mean, it's not a nice story, obviously, but it's good to see, you know, the whole thing end to end, right, and to see who they're targeting. And in this case, yeah, I mean, essentially everybody of importance at Al Jazeera plus a bunch of other, you know, media personalities getting compromised by, you know, nation state grade, you know,
yeah, no iPhone, no click, yeah, no click iOS malware. Yeesh.
Yeah, exactly right. Which is, I mean, for people who are currently in the media, you know, right this very second, you know, that's pretty intimidating. You don't want to be on the wrong side of someone that has that kind of capability. And yeah, like, rough time to be a Qatari journalist, clearly.
Yeah. Next up, North Korea versus Israel. Fight.
Yeah, well, oh dear, that's not one we want to play out in any serious way. Apparently the Lazarus Group, North Korea's hacking crew, have been going after some of the defense people in Israel. It's not exactly clear who it was that was being targeted, but or whether it's industrial espionage, whether it's something else. But yeah, a couple of campaigns targeting defense industry in Israel.
Yeah, I just wonder if this is like a Leroy Jenkins! Kind of moment for Lazarus Group.
Yeah, they may have bitten off more than they can chew here, I wonder.
We'll see. Staying with Israel, and the Defense Ministry has apparently revoked some licenses of a company that does sell spyware. That's interesting.
Yeah, this is a company, Ability Security Systems, had their export license revoked. We don't really understand why. Obviously, Israel has a bunch of laws on the books to try and, you know, limit the extent to which their arms and, you know, kind of surveillance industries can sell, but, you know, perhaps less so than some other countries. But yeah, we're not quite clear exactly what's going on with this and what they did.
Yeah, Mike Burgess, the head of the ASD here in Australia, did a public speech in which he actually outlined some of its operations against Islamic State. And there was stuff like, you know, taking out their comms while there was an actual battle going on so they couldn't coordinate, and that was disastrous for them. Why on earth they were using anything IP-based for comms? Like, that just seems like a really bad idea, personally. But yeah, they've also detailed efforts of, you know, how they've gone after some of these guys, like locking them out of their servers, destroying propaganda material, stuff like that, right? You know, the good stuff that you would hope agencies like this are doing. I don't think it's inappropriate at all for them to actually talk about this stuff. I think that's a good thing. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense. I mean, we don't see how much goes on behind the scenes, and there's a lot of people who, you know, attribute all sorts of crazy to the, you know, to the intelligence services and in the cyber domain that is just not in any way informed by reality. And obviously having some reality to, you know, to being communicated out of the intelligence world, I think, is just good for people understanding what this is being used for, and therefore by extension what it's not.
Yeah, well, I just want to say well done, Carl and friends, right? Because that, I think the timeline there fits with his tenure. So nice job. Very nice job. Oh, now this one is interesting. You know, we've seen a lot of these scams where, you know, criminals just email people and say, you know, you've got to transfer money over here. Like, I'm the CEO. You've got to pay our parts supplier stuff, and people do it. Well, the employee of this media company did that, and now they're being sued by the company for falling for the email scam. This seems like a bad precedent if the lawsuit is to succeed.
Yeah, it's an interesting case though, because the boss of this particular organization apparently specifically told the employee that they weren't planning on paying anyone, and then she went on holiday, and the employee who was handling accounts acted on an email that claimed to come from the boss that had just told her that they weren't going to do any of this, and she went out and paid out a couple of £100,000 pounds, I think, so, you know, not a small amount of money, and then the bank that was doing the transfer specifically said, hey, this looks dodgy. Are you sure? You know, check this box to assert that you understand that we think you're doing something dodgy and you say it's fine. And employee checked the box. And I think that's the kind of the basis of the case here, is that maybe they should have stopped and asked a little bit, and that they didn't.
Yeah. I don't know though. I mean, if the bank can flag it like that, I mean, surely they should require some level up authentication on the transaction. So I just feel a bit weird that an employee is going to get, you know, sued for being derp. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's probably legitimate grievances on both sides of this case.
Sounds like it. Yeah. Moving on. And Utah has just introduced what I think is a fantastic law. And, you know, basically what they've done here is they've introduced a law where, you know, how the police can just go to some of these marketing intelligence firms and buy information on people's movements and things like that, like data about people. This bill would prevent police from being able to do that without first getting a warrant. And personally, I think that's a great idea. I mean, I remember actually speaking with Alex Tilley, former Australian Federal Police guy who's now at SecureWorks. I think it was last year at AusCert, I was having a conversation with him about this and asking him, when you were at the federal police, could you do that sort of thing with this sort of information? I think where it landed was he wasn't quite sure, but personally, I think, you know, you should have to get warrants for that sort of stuff. And Utah agrees, and it's very interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the US, they have this idea of the third-party doctrine, where when you have given your information to a third party, then that you don't necessarily – that third party doesn't have the same obligations in terms of protecting that information. So police are able to go to, you know, data brokers and phone carriers and businesses and get information with a much lower, you know, standard of requirement. I think the law in Utah here is to try and make a state law that says that in Utah you actually do have to have, you know, a warrant or – I mean, in some other jurisdictions, like in New Zealand, for example, there's some requirement for a, you know, for a production order or an Anton Piller order or similar sorts of things that are less than a warrant, but at least have some degree of oversight.
Well, an Anton Piller order is a whole other thing because that's like a civil thing, and you know.
Sure, yeah. There are some less than warranted mechanisms for, you know, asserting that you have a reason to do so.
But as I understand it, this would stop them from using their credit card to go and buy that information. I think that's really what this is about.
And yeah, that, I mean, that's the thing that, you know, obviously this debate about access to third-party data is important to have. And the fact that you can just buy it, you know, clearly goes against people's expectations, I think. So it's good that they're starting to face it, even if it is only at a state level.
The law requires law enforcement to obtain a warrant with probable cause in order to access any electronic data held by a third party. So that is interesting. I'm not sure how it applies to metadata, but I'll definitely be doing a bit more research on that one this week. Office Depot in a whole bunch of trouble. I just can't believe the predatory behavior of some companies out there, particularly retailers, where you would think their reputations are kind of important. But walk us through this one, because my mind is blown.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, Office Depot and one of their partner companies had this scam going where if you bought a computer from them or you brought a computer into the store because you were worried about, virus infections or something, then they would, you know, have a service desk that would run some kind of antivirus scanning for you. And this scanning service would basically say, you know, you've got malware, you totally need to buy our product that will solve it, even when the actual technical scanning didn't show up anything. And they had this like sort of a questionnaire that you did beforehand, like, is your computer slow and does it crash sometimes? And if you said yes, which let's face it, if you brought your computer into the Office Depot to have it looked up, chances are it probably is doing something. If you checked any of those boxes, it would just say, yes, you should buy our, you know, $300, you know, anti-malware service or whatever it was, which, yeah. Pretty shady.
Yeah, well, the FTC was all over it, and now they're having to pay $35 million in settlements with the agency. I think they're having to offer refunds and things like that. What's really crazy about this, though, is that, you know, a lot of the mainstream AV packages, they do flag stuff to make it look like you need, you know, like you really need their product. They're quite verbose, but that's legal. Like, what just blows my mind here is they've gone that extra step and just completely falsified results, like when you don't even need to. Now, this next one, you know, is probably one of the more significant stories of the last month. And this is about 3 weeks old now, but Microsoft has warned that they are indeed pulling the plug on Windows 7 support and security updates real soon. And, you know, that's a big deal because there's an awful lot of Windows 7 out there.
Yeah, there sure is a lot of Windows 7 out there. I mean, not everyone's updated to Windows 10 or what's the other Windows in between that no one used? Was it Windows 8, I guess? So.
Yeah, and you know, the reason there wasn't a Windows 9 is because it was confusing a lot of software that was using a string match on Windows 9 to identify Windows 95. I just think that's 95. Great. That's why they had to skip that. They went 7, 8, dear. 10. But this deadline is looming. I mean, we're talking about January 14, 2020. And then that's it. No more security patches. And I think they timed it reasonably well with XP. XP was mostly dead when they ended that support. But Win 7, I don't think we're going to be anywhere near the same position with Win 7 as we were with XP when they finally pulled the pin on that. This seems like an ambit claim. I think they're going to drag this out. They'll have to.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying, 40% of the market's still running Windows 7, which seems less than I expected. But, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of Windows 7 out there. And, I mean, you know, Microsoft have, you know, there is some historical precedent for them, you know, issuing security updates after the end of life. They did it for XP.
Well, they are saying that they're going to offer, you know, enterprise support with extended security updates until 2023. And I think what they did with XP is they just made that eye-wateringly expensive. So eventually people did the sums and figured out, you know, a desktop project was going to cost less than the support on their XP.
And I'm sure they will do it again. That's definitely one of their plans, I suspect.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a feeling it's less about raising revenue and more about just, you know, kicking people into 5 years ago. Let's see. Oh, now a bit of a roundup here just of all of this awful stuff that's been happening in the sort of Magento WordPress world. I got some audio for that as well. But first one off the rank is this Magento bug that allows card skimming. We're just seeing So much badness. That's a bad one. I've also linked through to a Twitter thread from a company called Warfare Plugins, and they had a real bad time with active exploitation of one of their plugins. And the reason I've linked through to the Twitter thread is if you scroll it, holy shit, you're going to see a lot of angry customers in there. Like it is a thread that will make you wince. And then, of course, was the strange case of Pipdig. Did you catch this one, Adam?
No, actually, I didn't. I don't pay a lot of attention to WordPress plugin drama, but this one is particularly drama-filled, it turns out.
This was
Like a WordPress plugin that was being distributed alongside some theme pack, so people may not even necessarily have realized that they were running it. And it had all sorts of crazy going on, like, you know, it had this remote kill switch where they could, like, the plugin would check in with the vendor and then had an option to, like, drop your database.
It's amazing. I got some audio here from Mikey Venstra from WordFence, who's been doing a lot of the work on this, and here's him explaining some of the weirder aspects of this Pipdig thing.
At the end of March, the WordFence team was sent an anonymous tip about some curious code that had been identified in a WordPress plugin called P3. P3 stands for Pipdig Power Pack. It's a helper plugin bundled with WordPress themes that are sold by a company called Pipdig. In the code, we identified some questionable functions like the ability for Pipdig to remotely destroy a site's database or change the password associated with a given user account. And we found some code responsible for what we believe to be a DDoS campaign against their competitors. We notified Pipdig of concerns that we had with the code itself. They in turn responded and seemed to suggest that nothing was quite what it seemed and that everything was actually okay, but they still went and immediately removed all of the offending code and released a patch within hours. They followed up with some public responses, continuing the line that nothing was really wrong, nothing untoward was happening. But in these responses, they never really made any mention of why so much obfuscation was used, like the password reset function, for example. Code used to change a user's password to a hard-coded string in the plugin was named P3 Check Social Links. Other similar cases of obfuscation where comments and variable names and function names didn't really line up with what the code was doing were common, and Pipdig has really said nothing to that fact at all. Following our initial report and then a follow-up a few days later, it was identified that some other DDoS behavior was also associated with their Blogger themes. These themes were causing some third-party JavaScript to be pulled from Pipdig servers when any visitor hit one of the sites using those themes. And as of days ago, it was still pointing traffic through a service called nullrefer.com and then finally to one of their competitors' sites. The community is not happy about it. Pipdig's responses have been unsatisfactory, if not outright false, and we're just sort of waiting to see what ends up happening here. I know that their hosting provider has been investigating them. The last JavaScript snippet that was in the code that was still directing DDoS traffic as of April 2nd, I think, that had to have been taken down by the host and was actually commented out with a note from their hosting provider.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a commercial entity acting straight up gangster. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, like it really does seem like the WordPress plugin scene is, you know, like IRC hacker scene from the 90s or something. Oh. You know, DDoS and the competitors and stuff. Oh, geez.
Now, you might remember too, just as a disclosure, WordFence did actually sponsor an episode of Risky Biz, but that was quite a while ago. We've got no commercial ongoing relationship with them whatsoever. But they're doing really cool work in this space, and I've linked through to one of their blog posts. Harold Martin of the NSA has pleaded guilty to, you know, leaking classified data. He's facing 9 years in prison. He told the judge it's time to close Pandora's box. He said that more than once, apparently, in his when he went to plea. He's got a penchant for the dramatic, doesn't he, Mr. Martin?
He does a bit. And one of the downsides, I guess, of him pleading guilty is that we haven't seen much detail come out. I mean,
You're not going to anyway. Even if it was a trial, they would have censored the good bits. Really interesting report on GPS spoofing attacks that look to be, mysteriously appearing over Russia.
Yeah, they appear to be using GPS spoofing quite a bit. I mean, in the places you'd expect, you know, near Crimea and around Ukraine. But yeah, interesting report on a number of places where they've seen the Russians, you know, using GPS spoofing and not just jamming, like actual active location spoofing, you know, in a bunch of places inside Russia around, you know, things that they don't want surveilled by drones and that kind of thing. So yeah, interesting report with a bunch of details.
Yeah. Syria as well.
Yeah, well, you can imagine them doing it there. You can see why.
36 new security flaws in LTE protocol have been discovered. In the LTE protocol have been discovered by South Korean researchers by using the cutting-edge bug hunting technique of fuzzing.
Yeah, and rigging up a fuzzer for LTE. Doesn't sound like a whole bunch of fun, but yeah, these four people did actually do it, and yeah, bugs just fell out left, right, and center, much as you'd expect, unfortunately.
Yeah, AT&T and Comcast have been testing a protocol called Shaken/Stir, very nicely named. But the idea is to stop robocalls. It's some sort of, you know, crypto-backed way of authenticating caller ID. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially this is the network that's originating the call can sign requests that are going across the handovers into other carriers, and then they can use that to validate that the numbers, their originating numbers are correct. So, you know, it seems like rather a heavy-handed, you know, have to go full crypto for this. Like, surely they can manage to figure out where phone calls are meant to be coming from. But, yeah, interesting step, although, you know, you got to think, like, maybe 20 years too late.
Yeah. Apparently Facebook was storing hundreds of millions, like something like half a billion user passwords in plain text for years, which is not the best. Krebs had that story. There was another story doing the rounds about like a huge Facebook data exposure, and that was UpGuard hyping that because they found, you know, some bucket or something with all of this information in it. Turns out it was actually public information, so that story was kind of a bit of fake news, folks. Fake news. It's possible that that was a little bit of fake news. Krebs also reports that Tyler Barris, who's the 26-year-old who was arrested over that fatal swatting incident, he's been sentenced to 20 years in federal prison, which means, you know, he's unlikely to get sentence reductions. You read this story and you realize how much of this swatting he was doing. It's pretty difficult to feel sorry for the guy. So we can kind of close the book on that one. What else have we got? And I'm kind of going into turbo mode to get through all of the news this week.
So much news.
So much news. Dream Market is apparently going to shut down April 30. This is after a bunch of arrests. I think the admins are looking a bit nervous, but of course everyone's really worried that, you know, law enforcement's already taken over the site. It's one of those typical situations. what else have we got? Oh, I love this one. Some Lithuanian dude has pleaded guilty to scamming Google and Facebook out of $123 million. Now, this is a boring scam, really uninteresting. I just think it's amazing that it worked to that degree. He was just sending them fake invoices and they were paying them, which reminds me of the guy in Australia who set up a fake mining industry magazine and started sending like BHP and Rio Tinto invoices for like full page ads that didn't exist and they were paying them. But yeah, 123 mil.
That's some serious cash. And he was just, you know, he was pretending to be one of the like Taiwanese hardware vendors that they deal with and just sending them invoices for servers and, you know, equipment that they hadn't bought, and $123 million. The question, of course, is at the point where he'd got, you know, 50 or 60 or 100 million, like maybe stop at that point. Like,
you're going to get addicted to the free money. But yeah, he started a company using a very similar name to Quanta, which is a, you know, data center hardware product company. China is apparently going to ban cryptocurrency mining because it's stupid, which I think is a great idea, but could have some interesting effects on the ecosystem given that 70% of mining happens in China.
Yeah, now this one actually could be quite interesting, you know, and also seeing the Chinese government do something sensible for a change is nice, I suppose. But yeah, you got to wonder like whether this is going to tank Bitcoin and the related cryptocurrencies once and for all.
Yeah, 1 million Uyghurs in concentration camps. Bad. Banning mining, Bitcoin mining. Good. It's a bit of a mixed bag in China. Oh boy, are we going to close with the best skateboarding dog of all time? This is it's incredible. So good. The
I've
single
been waiting all segment.
The best patch of all time from Cisco. This is the best way to patch a security bug. This is so stupid. I can't believe it's real. Adam, tell us about this.
So a while ago, we talked about there were some bugs in some Cisco like small business routers, like the Cisco, I think, RV320 small business router. And we laughed at it because it was like mem corruption in the login box. Like you just stuck a lot of long string, you just stuck a long string in the password field, memory corruption, remote exploit, job done. Anyway, the exploit scripts that were doing the rounds to demo this, you know, obviously got passed on to Cisco's team to remediate, and they fixed it by requiring the front-end proxy in front of the web service to throw out any requests where the user agent is curl.
There you go. Curl. Problem solved. I can't even.
Dear, oh dear. Yeah. Cisco, what are you doing?
Just how? How?
Well, they fixed it, right? I mean, the script doesn't work anymore.
God. Absolutely terrible. Dear. Absolutely terrible. But look, funny, right? So, yay. I don't know. Yeah, thanks for the lulls. Cisco. Well, mate, it's fabulous to be back. It's great to be chatting again about the InfoSec news. We laugh, we cry, you know, all of that. It's been a lot of fun, and we're going to do it all again next week. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, no, it has been. It's been nice to get back on the wagon and see all of the crazy things that have happened in 3 weeks away. Hopefully the next week will be a little more straightforward and a little less crazy.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the security news of the last few weeks. A quick paid announcement now. Trail of Bits, a Risky Business sponsor, is running an OS Query Conference in New York in June. QueryCon will take place from June 20 to 21 in downtown Manhattan and will feature 2 days of talks by OS Query and OSQL engineers. There are no sales talks. It's $300 and it's a great event if you're interested in OS Query. I've dropped some links through to information about this in this week's show notes, information on the con. And yeah, they ran this last year in San Francisco and about 120 people rocked up. So definitely a worthwhile event if you're OS Query curious, and also if you want an excuse to visit New York. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Kumud Kalia, the Chief Information and Technology Officer of Cylance. They're best known for their AV tech, but they dropped a really interesting product announcement at RSA. It's called Cylance Persona, and it's the type of thing that I'm used to seeing in academic papers, not in real products. Basically, it's a software agent that you install on a workstation that monitors the behavior on that workstation and profiles it with machine learning algos. It looks at things like the types of software the user normally uses, where the user normally connects, you know, how they use things like their keyboard and mouse, that sort of stuff. Now, once those values start to drift from what the model thinks is acceptable, once those things start going a bit weird, the agent can then take action. It's an interesting idea, but of course, the devil will be in the detail with anything like this. So, Kumud Kalia joined me to talk about Cylance Persona, and here's what he had to say.
We're building up a baseline per user based on, you know, their activities, sort of time of day, applications, websites they access regularly, connections their computer makes to other devices, as well as things like keyboard and mouse activity. So we take all of that in, and we develop a composite score. And that score, think of it like a credit rating that will adapt based on activity changes. And so when an action happens or some activity changes, that score will change. So we start off with assuming sort of a perfect score, and then we degrade that score based on unusual actions. And so what we've designed this to do is, based on a degradation of that score, you'd probably want to do some kind of secondary authentication, some kind of challenge to the user to make sure it is the user who you think it is. In which case, then that would just get absorbed as an anomalous activity, but not a malicious one, and it would just get absorbed into their profile. But if it was correlated with something that was malicious, then we could take a more severe action. So rather than a challenge for authentication, it could be a disconnect your device from the network or something like that, or kill the process that started. So we can customize those responses. And, you know, I should probably back up a little bit in terms of how we got here. But we have a response engine within the Cylance platform. And so we're fully leveraging the capabilities of that response engine to take these automated responses based on that degradation of the score that I just described.
One of the criticisms you could throw at this thing just from a conceptual point of view is that if you turn the dial up, to make it super cautious, it's going to be annoying the absolute shit out of your users.
Yeah.
And if you turn it down too much, it's going to be kind of useless, right? So how do you actually manage to straddle that line to make it useful and not annoying? Because I just imagine that would have been, you know, probably the last year of the dev work on this would have been around that.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing some alpha testing within the organization. And, you know, we've been trying to adjust it for our type of organization. And, you know, it varies a lot, even by department.
Yeah, because I was thinking call center operator, no problem, right? But I mean, I look at what I do, right, just on my system, and it varies so much depending on the day, right? Like I'm recording and editing and going nuts on Wednesdays. You know, Mondays, the US is closed. I'm not even touching my audio gear, but I'm doing different types of work. So I just imagine, you know, in those situations where you got really varied tasks, you know, for a user, that's where it's going to be a little bit complex.
Yeah, so I think what we would have chosen to do, right, if we were adopting this product from you, we would have set up different levels of response based on different groups of user. And so our platform already allows what we call zones, groups of users that we can take different actions on. And so we're going to leverage that capability we already have and just say, all right, these zones can now have different profiles based on user behavior. And that seems to work out okay. But I think, you know, organizations have different risk appetites. So you have to look at the sort of, you know, three-letter agency in the U.S. government has a very different level of risk tolerance than, say, you know, a tech company where their developers are downloading tools every day from the internet.
Well, I guess this, you know, leads me to my next question, which is, who is this for, right? Is this for those paranoid high security environments? Is this for just everyone, you know, because you think this is something that all endpoints should have? Like, what's the, you know, what's the idea here?
I think all enterprises can use this. You know, the thing that we had started with at Cylance was securing the endpoint. And, you know, we did a good job of that, of preventing bad software from running on an endpoint. And we showed that, you know, we could do that well, and we could even predict ahead and protect against threats that hadn't emerged yet. And then the sort of next phase of that was the response, taking automatic actions based on things that have been detected. And I think the sort of gap that was left in terms of enterprise security was the insider risk through lateral movement. So if somebody gets into your network and they move laterally and escalate privileges, and then they have access to all sorts of things, do lots of, you know, whether it's data or sabotage or something, you know.
So the intention here is to really catch that user account that's been first to be popped and is trying to, you know, escalate and move laterally through the enterprise.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so things that are adjacent to a user's normal behavior wouldn't degrade the score that much, right? If you're just looking at a new website, but it looks like a fairly innocuous website, you know, we can tell sort of a few things about what you're doing, then it would just be, you know, considered significantly the same as what you do. Whereas if you start doing something totally different, opening up sockets to, you know, you have never done before, connecting devices you've never done before.
So it sounds like the keyboard mouse stuff is less really how this thing works. I mean, that's a nice one for the, you know, for the press releases. It seems like it's much more about actually looking at, you know, more meaningful activity on the device.
That too. And the keyboard mouse stuff is, you know, everyone has a fairly unique signature based on how they use those things. So it's a relevant part of the model, but it's by no means, you know, weighted as the heaviest part of the model.
Yeah.
So think of it as, you know, we have a bunch of machine learning models in place. The keyboard mouse ones are a smaller component of that, but they are there. You know, we'll know if it's someone else using the device. But someone else using the device might be okay, depending on what your environment is.
So I guess though, you know, that is useful if someone pops like an endpoint and, you know, starts doing some weird stuff, trying to move laterally from that endpoint. But I'm wondering, you know, do you have something that monitors credential use centrally, right? Like that plugs into
Active Directory or whatever, and can watch for people's creds doing unusual things? Or is this purely looking at the accounts as they're being used on the endpoint? Does that make sense? Because like you've got these other products out there which will actually watch all account events, and some of them actually use a bit of machine learning to see when accounts are popping up where they shouldn't, things like that. Or is this really just about solving that problem of like this endpoint has gone rogue?
Yeah, I think those are all activities we can feed into our model to create that composite score. And so we haven't done them yet, but you know they're in our sort of potential things to add. We wanted to get something up and running, see how it works in the wild, and then see what else we have to augment or add to it. And so,
is this something you've built into your existing agent as well? Is this just something that you enable as part of your, you know, Silence Protect deployment, or is this a completely different agent?
For our alpha test, it was a different agent, and for our release, it will be combined.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Just to have the engineering focus on it, we didn't want it to be bound by any other releases going on the platform. So we had it sort of done as a skunk works, if you like.
Yeah.
And now we're going to integrate it into the platform. So it will be just another thing you enable as a part of the platform, if you choose. We can add and augment to the models. We wanted to prove out that it worked. And so getting the models built and then doing the alpha test was really a proof of concept, a validation of the idea that we can build it and it will work. And then we can look at how to augment it and improve it.
Yeah.
We haven't moved to the other account credential kind of behaviors yet, but it seems like a natural thing we'd want to add.
Yeah, it seems like a logical place to go, right? Like, and I'm just wondering, can you give us a couple of examples of some cool stuff that you've actually picked up with this?
I don't know if we've detected anything ourselves with it. We're a pretty, as you can imagine, sophisticated company, but very security aware. So I think what we've done is we've thrown simulations at it, faked out some behaviors to see if the tool would catch it, and it did. And so that could be logging onto a server that you haven't done before. We have actually tried to break the keyboard and mouse models with different behaviors and different people. And after a while, it's not as immediate as we would like, but it did detect that it wasn't the same person. So there's some improvements we want to make there. But the key thing about this is it's meant to be an instantaneous, immediate response. It's a real time per endpoint. And so real time for us right now is maybe a second or two, and we'd like to get that down and down to sort of in the millisecond range, and then we'll know, we're doing something really good.
Yeah, yeah. I guess my final question is, like, is this being priced, at a comparable level to, like, the AV solution, or is this more like, give us an extra 20% and you get this functionality? Like, how much of this is designed to be, like, a standalone thing that people are going to want to buy on its own versus just, like, a nice added tick-the-box extra cost feature for Protect?
Yeah, this will be an extra cost feature. So you'd have our platform already, because we're making everything a single combined agent now.
Yeah.
So Protect and what we used to call Optics will, all be in the same agent, and then this persona will all be on the same agent. So it becomes a check the box and turn this on, and you'll be able to either buy it as a bundle, so you have everything into the platform, or you can go more a la carte and have a sort of custom price built for you based on, well, I don't want this right now, I want just these pieces, but I might add them later. So we're trying to give our customers as much flexibility as how they want to do this. My preference is keep it simple, just bundle everything in and do it for one price, but not all our customers want to procure that way.
No. All right, Kamud Kalia, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk us through Silence Persona. I mean, it's a very new product, right? And it sounds like, you've been doing the alpha testing and just using it internally, and you haven't been able to really expose it to, like a live fire range, right? So
yeah.
It'll be interesting to see the way that all shakes out. So thanks a lot for joining us to chat about it.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I look forward to the feedback and maybe sharing that with you as well. Our first early adopter customers, I think, are going to be getting their hands on this in about 3 months. So maybe sometime later in the summer, we can update you on how it went.
That was Kumud Kalia there with a chat about Silence Persona, their upcoming software. They demoed it at RSA, and as you just heard, it should be out there in about 3 months from now. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.